title of this set of reflections I'm giving is supposed to be called Liturgical Lessons from the Past. My idea is to take liturgical history and crack open a time period or a problem or a solution or a practice and be able to make some comparisons with the current situation. I hope myself not to make those comparisons. I apologize in advance if I say anything relevant in the next 60 minutes. It was a mistake. All I mean to do is set the one pole. You yourself are the other pole, because you occupy this century, and we'll see if some electricity arcs between the two arenas. So as for the pole we're up to today, when I was a kid, it was something of a Sunday ritual to watch Ed Sullivan on Sunday nights. And Ed had an act on about every 2 weeks, it seemed, but I suppose it was every 6 months. So someone who did these spinning plate tricks, remember those acts? Started with plate spinning, and then the second one, he had to go back and start the first one, then he got the third one, he had to speed the second and the first one. I guess the entertainment was watching the guy run himself ragged trying to get the 12th plate going. Well, we're going to do something like that in here, except I hope you to be the plates and me to be the spinner. And the plates that I'd like twirling around up in the air are sets of questions. I hope to create a question, or maybe a dozen of them. We'll see how successful I am. I hope not to answer these questions, but just to create the question. Now, what good would it do to create a question if there's no answer following it? Why would someone do that? They might just be mischievous. They might be kind of snide, a little sarcastic about it. They might just enjoy the intellectual anarchy of always asking questions and never letting anything settle. But I hope not to be doing this for any of those reasons. I think that it's something of an advancing information to get up answers. But I think it's something of an advance in conceptual thinking to get the question straight. And so one thing at a time, we'll just work on the questions here. I'm going to do three things in case you're a scorekeeper types. I want to explain the Edict of Constantine and the effect it had upon the church in the 4th century. I want to create a whole slug of questions, and then I want to end with two or three quotations and closing remarks. So I get to talk for a minute first, and you will help me create the questions, you will see. Up until 313, the law in the Roman Empire read, Non licet esse Christianos. Christians may not exist. Non licet is against the law for Christianos to esse, to be. There can't be Christians, they can't exist. There wasn't constant persecution for those 300 years, but it was off and on, and there were three great persecution periods under three emperors who particularly shot after the Christians. Still, the law stayed on the books, and it was uncomfortable. It was risky business to be a Christian. In 313, the emperor, Constantine, issued an edict of toleration. In effect, striking that law from the books. Christianity wasn't the official religion of the empire yet, not for another 70 or 80 years later in the 4th century, Trajan, I think around 383. But Constantine made it legal to be a Christian. Why he did that is the subject of many a PhD dissertation, I'm sure. You can find people at the far extreme on one end who take the legend seriously that circulated about Constantine. He saw a vision of a cross in the sky, and a voice said, under this standard go forth and conquer, So he did. He took the emblem of the cross, put it on his shields and on his soldier's shields, and he went forth and conquered. They won a decisive battle on which the future of the empire held, hung. And so Constantine was, in this story, converted by a miraculous vision, and it was a heartfelt conversion. There are others on the far opposite end of the scale who discount that story altogether and point to shrewd political, economic reasons for Constantine's shift. Christianity was already a force to be reckoned with, and Constantine was, let's suppose, doing nothing more than Gorbachev did when he allowed the liturgy to be celebrated in the Basilica in Red Square. This was a purely political move. He needed the moral force of the Christians on his side. So somewhere between those two extremes lies the truth. But I'm not interested in that. For whatever reason, Constantine made Christianity legal. And when the church could come forward, didn't have to keep such a low profile, lots of things changed. Like what, you asked. In the series of their sequence of their appearance, there was a rather significant influx of new members. Well, let's stay on the sarcastic end of the line here. You can imagine a couple people talking, say, do you know what I heard? What did you hear? Constantine's become a Christian. Say, I think I might become a Christian too. What's a Christian? Well, I don't know. Whatever the emperor is, it must be good. There's this influx of new members, like, into a vacuum. There's not enough catechumenate time to particularly form these Christians, so the risk of a kind of a lukewarm level of commitment rises sharply in the century following this. You understand I'm going to speak about this as if it happened overnight, but, you know, say from 313 to 400, this is a time period. Influx of new members. Where are you going to put all those new members? You need bigger churches. And the style of the church that they built is called a basilica. Wasn't a religious building, wasn't a Jewish temple, wasn't a pagan temple. The basilica was just a public building that they had figured out how to make really, 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 really big, quite large. You could put up a roof on top of a set of pillars like this, and if you needed a bigger building, you could add another set. And if you needed a bigger building, you could add another set. You could make that basilica stretch out as long as you needed to. There was a limit to how big the roof could be on a square, but no limit to how big the building could be if you went rectangular. And these basilicas had a rounded front entrance called an apse. It's kind of a dome like Carnegie Hall, or if you cut an orange in half and put the orange out, the peel that's left over. Here's this apse. And there was a chair where the official who conducted business in this official building sat. Here's where Judge Wapner sat, if this is where People's Court was being held. Here's where Mayor... who's the mayor of McDonald Land? Mayor...
McCheese.
That's right, Cheeseburger. Here's where Mayor McCheese sits, if McDonald's Land. Here's where Emperor Constantine sits. And if you had business with the emperor, you'd gather here, stand around, no chairs, of course. And when it's your turn, you come forward for business. Well, it suits the Christian purposes just fine. Here's a chair where the bishop can sit, the overseer, the one who conducts the official business of the community. And that chair, in Christian tradition, comes to be called a cathedra, which is the Latin word for chair. No more mysterious than that. And the buildings where the bishop's chair is located are called cathedrals. cathedral has nothing to do with how old the building is or how decorated or what the style of architecture is. It's just where the bishop of the diocese sits his chair for official business. And then you can put a altar table out here and people can gather, and it's a handy space for processions going up and down. So, bigger churches, basilicas, they go wild building basilicas, especially Constantine's mother, Helena, who also becomes a Christian and goes to Israel and builds the Church of the Holy Sepulcher over Christ's tomb in Jerusalem, and she builds the Church of the Holy Nativity in Bethlehem. With bigger churches comes bigger liturgies. Oh, now what do I mean by that? First of all, I mean bigger liturgical gestures. Think about it. If we were the church of the state of Washington, I mean, we gathered Sunday mornings, and I were the bishop, because I'm standing up at the moment, I could make rather small gestures to a crowd this size. I could say, "Peace the Lord be with you," or give a benediction, kind of small like this. But what if we moved from a community of 15 to 1500? In the Cathedral Church of Amiens in Paris, you can fit 10,000 standing. In cathedral churches in Romania, they fit 5,000, and they fill it twice each Sunday morning. What if you move from 30 to 300 to 3,000? What if you move from a space this size to Yankee Stadium or Fieldhouse, gymnasium of some sort? Well, if you're standing in a room of that size, then little kind of wiener gestures like this just don't cut it. You tend to make large gestures. The liturgical gesture has to fill the space. Likewise, the voice has to fill the space, and it's the beginning of chant. Saying the prayer on a tone that will carry it to the back. It would be as odd to do a big-sized liturgy in a small space as to do a small-sized liturgy in a big space. Processions become really big. If this was our altar, and here was our offertory, bread and wine, then here's our offertory procession. Nobody's uncomfortable with that. It wasn't too long, too short. But supposing you're in this space, and they collected offerings, in the Eastern tradition anyway, at the rear of the church, and now we're going to bring the offerings forward. And it takes not 4 seconds, as it took me, but 40 seconds? Long time to get the bread from the back up to the front? What do you do with all that empty time? Fill it in with processions and choir antiphons. Get the choir to start lobbing Kyrie eleisons back and forth to each other to fill in the time. Between one action and another action, it usually gets filled in with music of some sort. And particularly where you've got a kind of silent gap for a moment. So we've got processions and antiphons increasing. The art changes. I'm not very well versed in history of art, so some of you could perhaps fill me in better on this, but I understand that at the 4th century, the depictions of Jesus change distinctly from symbolic, maybe Jesus as the shepherd carrying the lamb, to beginning to have depictions of Jesus sitting on the throne, looking very much like Constantine, I mean not facially, but the throne, sitting on the throne with the Empress Helena, no, her name is Mary, the mother of the emperor. Mary sitting to the side, the emperor sitting on this throne, surrounded by the Senate, the 12 apostles, wearing royal purple, crown on his head. The artistic depictions of Christ begin picking up this age of Constantine. And then the one that I want to hang on most for a moment. we'll call it court ceremonial. If Christ is the King of Kings, then what you do before the King, if Christ is the Emperor of Emperors, then what you do before the Emperor, you do before Christ. Now, this isn't supposed to sound too mysterious. It's not supposed to really puzzle us too badly. I'm trying not for it to. Well, sometimes they say Bill Clinton came in the room, but, you know, there may be some diehard Republican in the room, so nobody would give them respect. Let's pick another Republican, someone that we'd all commonly respect. What if Mother Teresa came in the room? I might expect that you would stand up to greet her. You might not just sit back like this. Oh, yeah, hi, good to see you. You may, oh, hello. Someone that you were showing respect to, deference. Well, our culture is that you would stand up to show deference or honor or respect to someone. What did one do in the 4th century Byzantine culture to show a gesture of respect? Several people knew something. Kneeling, you genuflect. You've seen this on B-grade Hollywood movies when the Roman centurion comes in and Caesar, I've got this news for you, right? One genuflect. Well, that's what you did. To the private to the sergeant to the lieutenant. That's what you did when you came in front of the emperor. Genuflect. Some other voices were in here. What do you do to show in the 4th century Byzantine Empire respect?
Take off a hat.
If you had any headwear on, it might be removed. And carry that helmet under your... I'm still thinking of Victor Mature in some epic theater show that I saw. That's how it stands there.
Is there a gesture coming?
Some kind of gesture. There's another greeting which the French still do more than English and Americans.
Kissing.
When Christians came into the church, they kissed everything which symbolized Christ to them. They kissed the doorpost of the building as they came in. The priest kissed the altar, so the people didn't come to the altar. They kissed the book, kissed the bishop, and they kissed each other, the kiss of peace. The presider, the book, the table, and the community all symbolized Christ, and they kissed it. So I suppose I should be keeping score on some of these, and I'll forget them, that we've done them. The genuflect, kiss. How about when the emperor first enters the room, say he comes in back here and comes up to his chair, and there's kind of a, does he just shuffle on in by himself? Oh, no, no, no. It's kind of a parade, an entourage that follows. And the emperor is preceded by someone doing an honorific gesture, bearing incense. So the first person in, incense. Next two people carrying torches. Why? So you had a couple torches next to the book so you could read. But they can be carried in an official sort of manner. You might say officious, but I'm trying to steer you away from that kind of a judgment. Incense bearer, someone taking in candles, a couple of assistants carrying the books. Assistants known as acolytes. Not just preteens and Adidas coming out to light the candles, but someone who can assist, hold books, take this, take that. So they all process in to antiphons. They're greeted royally. There's this incense bearing. The emperor was identified by certain garments. If you were a member of the Senate, you got to wear a stole, a cloth around your neck. If you were a public citizen, sorry, a public servant, a senator who served the larger community, you wore this stole. And if you were in the junior House of Representatives, you wore the stole sideways over one shoulder. If there are any people from a tradition that have deacons, you can be nodding your head remembering the deacons wearing it this way. They wore a stole, and then on top of that, senior senators, chasuble, ABL, I think so. A large kind of cloak, poncho arrangement. Later, all of these were allegorized during a Franco-German period in the church. The stole, I guess that's like the yoke of Christ, and the chasuble is your cloak of charity. But it had no such symbolic function when it started. This is what senior members of the Senate, what the servants, the public figures, wore Monday through Saturday on the street. And the bishops began wearing this as well after the Edict of Constantine. So let's see, I've got torches, incense, genuflection, kiss. Oh, a certain headwear called mitre. That's mitre box. Headwear, the ring, a staff. The one in charge had a staff about five times as long as this, or a pole. If I were sending you with an official message from me, I might give you my staff, and when you go there, this is a signal that you're on my errand. You're my envoy. So the staff becomes the bishop's crozier. You've seen John Paul carry one with a crucifix on the top. Or some of the staffs, don't laugh, I'm no artist, had croziers that looked like shepherd crooks, or they're the shepherd of the community, the pastor. That's what the word pastor means, shepherd in Latin. See if I've missed something. Kiss, etiquette, headwear, footwear, lights and incense, kiss the hand, staff, ring, the chair itself. All right, close enough. All of this court ceremonial begins entering the Christian liturgy after the Edict of Constantine. How should we think about this? It is as if Christians, after three centuries of being underground, of having to conduct liturgies by the seat of their pants, so to speak, now receive permission to do it upright, to give God the glory in God's liturgy, which they would wish to do. And they took from their surrounding culture all the ceremonial which belonged to the grandest court ceremony they could, and they put it into the liturgy. And 9/10 of what you mean if you said, well, that was pretty high church, wasn't it? Comes from the court of Constantine. What my Grandma Johnson would mean, I'm Catholic now, but Grandma Johnson wasn't, and what my Grandma Johnson would mean when she says, well, that was a little Catholic, wasn't it? That's what they took from process in with the cross and the full nine chancel prancing. Smells and bells, fancy liturgies. Yes, this is where it came from. Now,
there's a question about class here, because it seems to me that the prevailing tradition of our history emphasizes a great deal about the lower classes of early Christian converts. So are these like the farm boys coming into town and being overawed by public buildings and then transferring that? Or is there really a difference now by the fourth century of the class of the church so that they know these kinds of things and have an appreciation for culture, art, music, and so forth?
Much more the latter. The reports of the research that I read indicate that in the last years, scholars have eased off the assumption that Christianity was such a country bumpkin process. The number of high-placed, high-socialite, educated Christians is pretty significant in by the 3rd century and by the 4th here. Mm-hmm. There's sizable wealth. There are bishops who are sufficiently educated that Constantine wishes to have them on his side and his payroll. That's one of the reasons for legalizing the church, so that he can give the educated and morally upright person in the community the job of local judge. So here's Augustine, who wants to be living something monastic-like, but becomes bishop and complains that he spends all his time settling disputes about the neighbor's dog who digs up the rose bushes. Please, yes, the bishop handles these tasks. He's educated, can be versed in law, etc. It's not quite as extra-urban as the original, as the initial researches were intended to paint it. A little more glamorous to have people in catacombs and hanging out, but in fact, the Christians, and particularly women, wives of senators and people like in the president's cabinet, particularly the women play a tremendously important role in the conversion of the empire.
Is this stuff you were describing here true just to a major city or capital like Rome, where you would have the emperor in residence and the senators living, or did this transpire also in a smaller community?
This would spread scattered. The way that we'd like to do liturgy out here in the hinterland is the way, as close as we could, I mean with as much respect and dignity and majesty and honor as we could. And that means borrowing what we've seen go on in court. So it was widespread. We might not be able to have a silk chasuble, but we could have a pretty fine woven dyed one. But we would have a chasuble. Now, the first question. What should we say about this event? Let's say two extremes again. I'll stand way to the right. Wasn't this awful? 313 should be mourned in the history of the church. Here is the first step down the slippery slide into wealth, pomp, pompousness, hierarchy. If only we could leapfrog back over 313 and do liturgy again the way Jesus did it around the shores of Galilee, then we would have the New Testament heritage. Far other side. Hurrah for 313! Let's hear a hip hip and hooray. After 3 centuries of struggling and barely making do, the church could at last take its place in society. Organize its charity, become a philanthropic force, could own property. Before this, it's illegal, so there's no corporation, so you can't pass property on from one generation to another. But now the church can own property. Let's give God the honor that God is due by doing the liturgy full-fledged. Was 313 the beginning of a step down the slippery slide into chancel prancing, or was it at last the flower opening up? You get the tone of the question. I want to try to put you into their sandals. By making us, this is part two if you're keeping score, by making us face the question which they faced. For one thing, it'll make us a little more sympathetic with another historical era. But for another thing, it provokes us to put the question in our own way. And here's the way I like to put it. Can liturgy borrow some things, anything, or nothing from its surrounding culture? They judged in the 4th century that they could borrow some things from the surrounding culture. Now, for instance, that incense. For 3 centuries, if you were accused of being a Christian, the test was that you came before a statue of Caesar and you had to drop a pinch of incense on burning coals and say, "Lord, have mercy on me." And if you wouldn't drop incense to Caesar, then that afternoon you're killed. There wasn't a lot of incense burning in Christian churches. Incense has a pagan connection. They burned it like crazy in the temples in order to mask some of the smell of the butchered animals. And they used incense for this test of life or death. There was no incense in the church for 300 years. Then after 313, the church is filled with smoke. Incense began being used in its cult, in its liturgies. Can liturgy borrow from its surrounding culture the use of incense? Well, no, not while it has this pagan symbolism, but yes, you might borrow it as soon as that's worn out. The church stood at this crossroads and had to face the question, can we use this? Can we dress them under chasuble? Can we have kissing rings? It's interesting, about 50 years before that, Bishop Paul of Samosata borrowed a lot of this court ceremony himself, and he was roundly condemned by the fellow bishops. But by 320, 350, 400, the church is on board this idea. I'd like to try to get you to play along with this game. I'll start, and as soon as you catch on, you'll see it. Can the liturgy borrow some things, anything, or nothing from its surrounding culture? Well, now, on the issue of music.
The gong that Abe's been talking about.
Guitars. Oh, my.
We've had organs, then we've had strumming guitars. How about electric guitars? I had one of those the other night. How about electric guitars played after the fashion of Guns N' Roses? You can borrow anything, nothing, or some things, but with discrimination. Let's take another one.
Conga drums.
Money is a rather significant part of our surrounding culture. Well, once upon a time, if you're going to make your offering to the church, let's say you brought a chicken. You had no coinage. You had no currency. Here's a 5 spot. You brought a chicken. Any problem? Does anyone have any problem with the shift from bringing a chicken to bringing a silver dollar? You don't mind if we fill the plates with silver? Do you have any problem if we shift from bringing gold coin to paper printed money?
No.
Any problem if we shifted from paper money to checks?
No.
Any of you write out checks? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't actually make an offering of $10, but you write out a check. Anybody have any problems if we were to go to credit cards? Let's just daydream for a minute. Our surrounding culture is filled with credit cards. How might we use credit cards in a liturgy? We aren't suggesting it. How might we use it?
Well, they're awkward, but you use it in front of the church in the narthex and fill it out, and then you put the paper in the plate, which is what usually is done. But it's slicker if you have checks that are pre-printed. And you just have to fill out your bank number, and that's what they do in retirement areas a lot. So they have all of these.
As part of the offer?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It's the pre-printed checks paid to the First Presbyterian Church and such, and you put your bank number in, your bank name, and its number, and you sign. And they're in the pew, just like the visitor card, except it's better.
I haven't heard this before. This is exactly the sort of...
Yeah, I've seen them in retirement. They're popular for some reason in retirement communities.
But you have to remember them to enter it in your checkbook when you get home. Right?
Yeah,
I don't understand. It seems like there's lots of room for error there.
Well, maybe the church could set up an automatic withdrawal. My mortgage, I never see.
Well, mortgage, never see. In Europe, they do.
Car insurance payments. Yeah. So you could sign off once a year, and the church could take an automatic withdrawal. Can we borrow some things? Anything? Nothing. How else might we use this plastic? A cash machine for those people. Oh, gee, I'd love to give something, but what am I going to do?
Well, you can use the bingo chips. But there are going
to be people like myself that don't believe in plastic and that don't believe in cash withdrawals out of your account.
They will come to people like you in a minute. For the moment, I'm trying to blow the lid off in order to give as much force to this question as possible.
I think one of the things that we were learning, or what we were talking to a friend this weekend, and they have this thing set up with the local grocery store. I mean, it's kind of like an offering. It's not during the liturgy, but they can buy gift certificates for the local grocery store. For every $100 they buy at the grocery store, the church gets $5.
Uh-huh.
So then she buys all of her prescription drugs at the grocery store, and then the insurance company reimburses her for her prescription. And so actually, you know, I mean, it's one way of giving offering to the youth group. It's not done during the liturgy, but it's with... So, I mean, I can see a way like that with these 1% cash back
sure,
on your credit cards. You can make a business arrangement with the church. And so if everybody had a Visa gold card and 1% of whatever you spent went to the church.
Nice.
I'm just recalling that the book of the late 60s, or maybe it was early 70s, Stranger in a Strange Land. And it seems to me that I recall that there's a scene in there about the future, the church of the future, in which they have slot machines in the narthex. And that's how you do your offering, before you even start.
Slot machines have the potential of gambling and return?
Yeah. I don't know whether that indicated...
Or if it's just a... fun
yeah,
way of doing it.
Yeah, whether God blessed you in the same manner.
You know, on the ends of the pews, you could put those little electronic sensors and you could run your card through as you came in, punch in the amount that you're...
Well, you genuflect, right?
Probably. Because it's keeping spiritual, after all. What else is big in American culture, and can we borrow anything from it? Television. How might television and liturgy intermingle?
It's on, liturgy's on TV every Sunday.
Broadcast liturgy to the shut-ins.
Virtual reality, you could speak to Jesus himself. I've already heard that.
Imagine a sea of people in pews with helmets on. Seventh heaven, here we go.
You could have a commentator, you could do post-worship analysis.
Make worship entertaining.
Oh, some already do that.
Entertaining. What did you say?
Closed captioning.
Is that?
Now, where would I see this closed captioning? Where's the screen?
Well, if you're watching, it could be up on the altar, right above the pastor's head, you know, kind of like they do the concerts where they show the pictures.
Kind of a rather large screen, but the camera stays close in.
We use big screen TV thing at our synod assemblies because there's so, and at like the welcome conventions, things like that, there's so many people, you have big TVs so you can see the speaker.
Because we've got a big basilica now, we're filling up the church, and we use big screens.
That's it. This church where they did the announcements, they had this, some sort of big screen over the guy's head. They had prepared announcements to Sunday school here was going to be here, and baptism by immersion was going to be at such and so place.
Flash him up there.
Yeah. I went to
could have a Times Square kind of a runner go by.
Crystal Cathedral has the drive-in church,
mm-hmm.
And so they've got it set up like a drive-in theater. You come in and you park next to one of the boxes, and you blow speaker in the window, and you watch the church on the big screen, and there's Robert Shore.
Now that seems like another category I'd like to set under. Cars are very important to us, and Schuller made his toehold by renting a drive-in theater Sunday morning, because they're all gone by Saturday night. And for people who are a little uncomfortable about coming into the church, you know, you might get buttonholed. Oh, hi, you want to hand out bulletin? I just kind of want to drive by. Right? Don't commit yourself. I've heard in Los Angeles of drive-through funeral homes, where it's awkward to have parking lots and get out and go in, but the body's behind glass on review. You can drop your card down the block. Some student brought me back a bulletin from a church which shall go nameless. Even its location I won't divulge, but the bottom of the bulletin was designed for those who are in their cars listening to the service over shortwave AM radio, and the bottom said, blink your lights if you want communion.
Yeah.
So I either imagine bellhops and roller skates bringing out another priest with communion on the window, or else you drive out and are given little hermetically sealed glasses of wine, and we already have those little shot glasses, don't we? So easy just to cellophane over them. And
they have them.
The bread is all right. It already comes stale, so it won't get stale.
They have prepackaged communion things.
Mm-hmm. Describe it, please. How does
it
go?
Well, I never saw it. My friend sold it for $50 one day to a pastor, but she was telling me about it. That it was prepackaged. You know, so it had the words of institution on the cardboard card, and then it had a wafer inside the cardboard itself. So you could see the wafer, and you said the words of institution yourself, and you tore open the cardboard thing, and then
it's not wine, it's virtues, and it comes advertised in these. Every pastor gets them of these packets of advertising, you know, 3x5 or postcard size advertisements. You scan through the lot of them, and I would say I get an advertisement for that about once a month. The only problem is it looks like it's a tear top, you know, like your orange juice on your tray in the plane for breakfast, and it always squirts. That does. So I can't imagine that you'd get by this grape juice without it spilling on you.
I'll have to keep my eyes open to find one of these one day and hang on to it for an illustration.
So much for communion as a meal.
Can you think of something else that's part of our culture? I mean, I got you going and you caught on real quickly. What else is part of our surrounding culture?
Language,
clothing. What about language, can you think? Inclusive language, that's already part of our cultural sensitivity. Do we take it whole hog, partly, not at all? So,
the church doesn't take
non-sexist problems of language. Clothing.
For many of us, I think getting dressed up is a means of showing respect. Mm-hmm. And some of us like to extend that to respect for God at church. Others feel much more comfortable being dressed as you are.
In church.
Yes. And we have people at our church in the same services who follow both of these. We get along nicely, I should say.
This is hard to articulate, but I think it happens subtly. People have a certain look. So whether it's sexual, it's like the Banner White, you know, you look for that certain look in a clergy or assistant. So it's a packaging. You know, it's kind of glamour that is in presentation that happens in liturgy.
It's usually the case that in any large group which is going to do a ritual together, you have to be able to identify the one presiding. And the all or the chasuble, or the stole, identifies it in some way. Here at Holden, the practice is bringing this stole, which comes from Constantine's, the Roman Empire. There's still this little stole brought around. Here's the person who's leading Vespers this evening. Some way of indicating who's who. Now, in our culture, you wouldn't bring a crown around. Oh, so it's a little bad. A piece of cloth around the neck. It only makes sense because there's no conditions to it, but nobody wears cloths around their neck in Washington, D.C. anymore. Could you preside in a suit? Some Protestant traditions in the Reformation threw aside vestments and wore academic preaching. The lecturing garb is what they wore when they were preaching. What style or what dress do you make? And this is from our culture now. Would an African culture require a different kind of targeting? What do we indigenize to the various cultures?
In the category, you're thinking of electronics, and both in terms of audio stuff and then also your computerized keeping track of your giving stuff.
And of members, I know pastors who have a program that kicks up all the names of people whose birthday is this day so that they can send a card to them. How might we think about electronics in the liturgy?
Your audio stuff, you know, besides being able to see who's up front to hear. So I'm thinking, well, sometimes you tell it, hold on, who's up, because the person that comes around behind the mic. And you might not have the stole on, but if they...
Mic is the signal. And nobody objects to using microphones, do they? You don't say, well, we can't let that television in there, therefore we can't let the audio in. We want them to only chant. We don't like microphones. Yet there might be a way of using it or not using it. I myself am a little bit bothered by a gesture which seems to me less liturgical than it seems Wayne Newton-ish. I mean, microphones with cords and it's little... call me old-fashioned, but I just don't see this as a liturgical gesture. Really, folks, I want to get to do something about this. Maybe get used to it eventually, but...
You don't have to.
Something. Again, fortunately, before that ingrained itself in the ritual somewhere, we got the microphones that click-click.
Excuse me, the paradigm that we've set up here is the assumption of mainline church, your larger basilica or cathedral, if you will. But the liturgical structure and all those things could be very much dependent on the size of the congregation and the population that they come from.
Even the building itself might require being subjected to the question, can we borrow from our surrounding culture the fact that big and busy and fast is getting tedious, so small group home communities, living room masses. That's what clicked to my mind. Did you have something?
Well, I mean, you know, whether you use a mic with a cord, I mean, that in some communities, that's far more appropriate than, a lectern, if you will. It really depends on who the indigenous people are.
We have the manufactured homes. You pop the semi-school buildings or whatever, you pop your portables out, and there's your church.
Quick Quonsets.
There seems to be a tension between respectful and traditional things and comfort. And I was thinking that one of the ways that my church is different is that we have chairs, but we're back to cathedral chairs. I mean, they're very comfortable and they're movable, and you can make a different space out of them. But the whole history of pews, this country is still stuck in pews, which means you have a huge building that you can't use for anything other than a public meeting. It seems, and they're very rarely are they in any other form except straight lines, so that nobody sees anyone else except who's in front of them. But it seems to me that, you know, what we've done is we went for a little bit of comfort from standing to sitting, and what were simply benches became the pathway to being legitimized, and now we're stuck in that, and a few people that have had other disasters hit their church get rid of them, and we're so glad.
I mean, I think that's sort of funny that certain things make it a legitimate church.
Yes, and if there are benches with no back at the back, then yes, add the padding, and why not add a cinerama seat,
right.
Which is the kind of layout of the certain huge cathedral, cathedral, huge auditorium sorts of churches, individual seats like Yankee Stadium layout. Why not? Any reason why not? That's the bugger that I'm trying to stick in here.
What is a cathedral chair that you mentioned?
It's simply a, it's intended to be for church. Some of them lock together, but ours don't. They have a place for kneelers and hymnals.
But it's individual chairs. Like
individual
it.
Chairs, yeah.
No, you were going to say something too.
Yeah, I was going to say that in our larger churches, really don't have a chance to visit with the minister either, whereas in your smaller congregations, you can visit with the minister. You can go out and have coffee with him or have lunch with him or something like that. In your larger congregations, I'm in a large congregation of 2,000, and it's, hi, how you doing? And that's it. Because the guy's busy. I mean, he is busy.
And
it's not the fault of him. Yeah. It's just the guy's busy.
And they say, all reports, that these mega churches are the way to the future. I mean, 10,000 in a church that has in its facility bowling alley and volleyball courts and the whole 10 yards is expected. I mean, this is what one seeks out.
Mm-hmm. Just a better way of saying what I was trying to say. I think what you described there is more the Mercedes of liturgy, and that there are BMW liturgies as well. I mean, there are Volkswagen liturgies as well. But it falls into alignment and has its own integrity.
I've got 7 minutes to pull this together. So this is a fine jumping off point. We've got these plates in the air. Can you do this? Can't you do that? Why not? There's the question I want. Why or why not? If you were inclined to pick any one of these on the board, I mean, you understand I'm not advocating any of these. I was just trying to make trouble. If you pick any one of these on the board and said, well, yes, I think we should do that. We may borrow that from our surrounding culture. Why? What's the point? What's the purpose? What's the aim of the gathering? If we knew what we were doing in liturgy, we might know how to do liturgy. If you thought that liturgy was an assembly of the people, the way the Old Testament talks about the kahal, or the way the New Testament uses the word ekklesia, meaning to gather together, well then, looking at the liturgy on the television at home with a mailed out communion packet might not cut it. If you thought that, if you didn't, then it wouldn't matter. If you thought that liturgy was mainly the transaction of an event by the people rather than entertainment, then your expectations would tip one direction or another. And I told you, I'm not answering any of these. I'm going around and spinning the plates again. What's the point? What's the purpose? Let me suggest a couple categories to make it easier for you to slot things in. For a long time, one of the difficulties of the Middle Ages seems to be that it operated under what I read one person describe as a logic of thing. The function of liturgical worship was to get the thing. What are we talking about? Grace. The golden dewdrop of grace. Now, that kind of thing metaphysic pervades Catholic scholastic theology. I love scholasticism, but it does have a logic of thing running through it. And it bumped off into many Protestant traditions as well. I told you I'm Catholic now, but I had a Lutheran background, and I know how the conversation goes when you do a home communion. Would you like the person here receive communion, and you ask the spouse or the family nearby, would you like to receive communion as well? And the answer always is, no thanks, I got it Sunday. Well, you got it already. You wouldn't want to get it again, because then you'd have two in your body, and who knows what it might do to you. If the Catholic scholastic version is this logic of thing, get the thing that the priest by virtue of ordination can create, it seems to me that the Protestant version of it, at least the Lutheran, is a medicinal model. I mean, they look upon the Eucharist as medicine. When our kids are young, they love the taste of grape diamond apple. And in the evening sometimes, boy, I'm getting a little diamond apple tonight. No. You know the answer that's coming, right? Every parent knows it. You can't have medicine unless you're sick. Apparently it takes 30 days for Lutherans to build up a charge of illness sufficient to require a dose of golden dewdrop. Otherwise, a cold compress of verbal absolution is sufficient. We wouldn't want to have communion too often. That grape diamond half, St. Joseph's aspirin. I need a little more aspirin. No, look at the bottle. 4 to 6 hours. Don't take it too often. Well, if you took it too often, it would just build up in your system and you'd explode. It would do more harm than good. Don't take communion too often. This logic of thing has functioned in the frequency of communion. And now that's, I forget, tomorrow or the next day, I'm looking at some historical reasons for the infrequency of communion. There's also, I believe, a logic of entertainment, by which I primarily mean a logic of feeling, a little shiver in your liver. The object of liturgy is to reach out, massage, and tickle you. Why? This is my assessment, and I'm bordering on sarcastic, but that's all right so long as I warn you of it. Why? Because you don't get to do anything. Rather, you go to watch liturgies. Look at the way the space is laid out. Look at who's talking all the time. Look at how often you sit. Now, anything that you have to go and watch over and over and over and over and over and over again gets kind of tedious after a while. Even cats can only stay on Broadway for so long before you have to change the play. If you're going to watch a birthday party, you get kind of tired after 25, 28, 35 birthday parties that you've watched. And you start thinking, gee, couldn't we put the creed here? Maybe we could have a real different kind of extravaganza there, because then it would be more entertaining to the spectators. What if liturgy wasn't a spectator sport? What if the people are expected, anticipated to engage in the liturgy? Then it might not be any more boring than, we'll say, eating supper again and again. Just think, in a few minutes we're going to go up there. We're going to sit down, we're going to have announcements, we're going to visit, and then we're going to pass the food around. How boring! Can't we do something different? Well, I don't find it boring, I find it kind of interesting to talk with people and have food again and nourishment. It's a tedious, repetitive structure. But if I'm not sitting in the corner of the room watching you eat your 100th meal, if I'm engaged in the act of eating, then I find it more interesting. And I'm making an argument that liturgy is neither come and get the thing, nor, I run out of logic of didacticism, pass the message, lecture. Gee, there'd be a lot more efficient ways to educate people than doing the liturgy. Then get rid of the church and bring out the slideshows. It's not education, it's not logic of thing, not logic of entertainment. I think liturgy is primarily transaction. The transaction of the community, the church, with its God. The faithful don't come to primarily be taught or entertained or receive this golden dewdrop. The faithful come to transact his or her business with God in ecclesial church community.
I'm just going to throw out that I call myself an ethnic Lutheran in a closet Mennonite. I've been associated with the Mennonites as a teacher for 10 years and worked with several Mennonite disaster service and so on. And frankly, we're kind of teetering between the two. When I go to the Mennonite church, I feel more like I'm part of the service. I never know what's going to happen next. I love the choruses. I love the simplicity of it. And yet when I get home, I think something in me wonders, did I really go to church? I didn't see the flowers. I didn't see the altar. The pastor didn't wear vestments. And I think, gee, now we're... So we're, for a couple of years, we've been teetering between the two. One Sunday we're in one church, and another Sunday we're in another. But it's kind of interesting. It's a different strokes for different folks trying to think which service is going to reach an individual person.
You have at least two plates running on the top. What's the function, the point, the purpose of the community gathering? What have they gathered to do? And then, while I agree that there are individual or culturally indigenous ways of expressing that activity, I'll argue that it's not a matter of taste. You say tomato, I say tomato. You like cherry pie, I like apple. You like this kind of worship, I like that kind of worship. I'd argue that worship should have a certain form. It should have a theological content and shape to it.